Well, good morning, everyone. I'm John Russell, the director of the Gallatin Historical Society, the 501c3 that operates the museum, the Pioneer Museum of Bozeman, and we're very glad you could be with us for the second of our three-part Saturday, May lecture series. Last week, we talked about a scout who was with the 7th Cavalry at the Little Bighorn. That scout happened to be from Bozeman. Next week, we're going to look at the Hebgen Lake earthquake of 1959, which I imagine a lot of you can probably still remember. But today, we're going to talk about what was known as Roosevelt's Tree Army, the Civilian Conservation Corps. Built under the auspices here of the Army Corps of Engineers. Well, the Tree Army and the Gallatin. Company 1963 had orders to leave Missoula. This was on July 13th, 1934, only 2 days after the 196-3rd had been established, with 1st Lieutenant Joseph Deverich, commanding officer, 2nd Lieutenant Howard Thomason was second in command. As soon as their orders were cut, Deverich and Thomason selected a mess sergeant and 20 civilian employees. These were local older men that they called LEMs. They loaded up 4 Army trucks with equipment and supplies, and they headed from Missoula for West Yellowstone. It was an Army unit, but it was not an Army unit that was supplied with rifles, grenades, or mortars. Instead, they carried picks, shovels, and other implements that would help them construct roads, bridges, and buildings. And upon their arrival at Basin Camp DF-73, the small contingent was joined by Forestry Service advisors and supervisors, and then by 170 recruits, most from Carbon and Muscle Shell counties. The 1963rd got to work. They built a 12-mile-long access road along Cliff Lake Road. They also built the ranger station office in West Yellowstone. The 1963rd was part of the Civilian Conservation Corps. This is a keystone in President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. A year earlier, when Roosevelt had been sworn into office, the Great Depression had already idled 25% of America's workforce. Industrial production had dropped by nearly half. Millions were homeless. As banks across the country closed, organized crime grew. In his campaign against incumbent Hubert, Herbert Hoover, Roosevelt promised a dramatic reduction in government spending, an end to unneeded offices and commissions, and a sound currency. And his message resonated. November 1932, he received 57% of the vote, and he carried all but 6 states. After his inauguration on March 4th, 1933, Roosevelt set out to give immediate relief and put the unemployed back to work. Among his earliest proposals during the 100 days was the Emergency Conservation Work Act. Its aim was to recruit thousands of unemployed young men and enroll them in a peacetime army, one that would attack destruction and erosion of the nation's natural resources. Roosevelt's sense of urgency persuaded quick action by Congress. The legislation was introduced on March 27th, and it took only 4 days to reach his desk, where it was immediately signed into law. Only 37 days elapsed from Roosevelt's oath of office to the induction of the program's first enrollee. Robert Fechner, a union vice president, was appointed the national director of the ECW, of which the Civilian Conservation Corps, or the CCC, was a branch. It was administered by the Army, the Agriculture, Interior, and Labor Departments, and the CCC recruited men between the ages of 18 and 26 who were unemployed and single. They also had to be U.S. citizens in good physical condition, willing to sign on for a minimum of 6 months. The pay was $30 a month, plus room, board, and a clothing allowance. However, each man had to send $25 of his monthly paycheck back home to help his family. It's interesting, you back up here a little bit with Robert Fechner. There were some union organizations that really had reservations about this, okay? But Roosevelt, whether you are a fan or not, you have to admit he could be clever. So in order to quell that, he understood, he sympathized, but he also felt the most important thing was to get people back to work. This was the easiest, most inexpensive way to do it, to put it under basically the Army and some other departments. So to keep the unions happy, he takes this guy and asks him to oversee the entire program. And the guy accepted, and it worked. Camps were established in each state, as well as Hawaii, Alaska, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. Because many enrollees came from the east, and most camps were in the west, the War Department mobilized the nation's transportation system to move thousands of these men across the country. An action credited with decreasing the crime rate in Chicago by 55%. Well, we all know the reputation of Chicago, the Capone and Company, and all of that during the Great Depression and during the waning days of Prohibition. Crime was rampant. A lot of these guys in Chicago now had an opportunity for employment and to send some money back home, so rather than committing crimes in the Windy City, they were able to join the CCC. But I always found that amazing that it decreased the crime rate by 55%. By the end of 1935, enrollment in the CCC peaked at 500,000, with more than 2,650 camps operating in all states. Native and African Americans were allowed to enroll, though their camps were mostly segregated from the whites. And as we saw that picture earlier, we don't really have definitive proof, but the few African Americans and Native Americans who would have been part of the CCC down in the Gallatin Canyon, it doesn't look like there was any segregation. I think a lot of that depended on what part of the country you were in. Montana was part of Region 1, the northern region of the CCC, governed by the Forest Service. It also included North Dakota, the northern Idaho Panhandle, and a small section of eastern Washington. The Montana, Idaho, and Washington camps also fell under the administration of the War Department's Ninth Corps. 25 camps were initially approved for Montana, though by program's end there were 26, and the work was demanding. Region 1 concentrated on transportation and structural improvements, and forest disease, and fire control. Access roads, fire lanes, and lookouts had to be built in the backcountry. The LEMS trained recruits, paying special attention to those from the east who had never used an axe or shovel nor worked at higher elevations. What an eye-opener it must have been for some of these guys to come from Chicago or New York or St. Louis and come out to the big sky country, you know? CCC administrators decided that smaller camps, known also as spike or fly camps, could be located away from the base camps to achieve greater efficiency in labor and transportation and to provide project diversity. In the fall of 1934, the 1963rd was ordered to establish such a camp further north, closer to Bozeman, along Squaw Creek. Men from Camp DF-73 built a 2-mile-long road from where the Squaw Creek Ranger Station stands to the selected campsite. The road became suitable for travel in just 10 days. As construction of Camp F-57, including a reservoir and water supply system, continued over the next 3 years, Recruits slept on straw mattresses in wooden barracks. When the camp was completed in 1937, the camp down at Squaw Creek, it had a peak enrollment of 400. Squaw Creek played an active role in forest fire prevention and control in Region 1. There were also structural improvements, including construction of the Squaw Creek Ranger Station. But the biggest impact left by this CCC camp would be a large concrete vehicle bridge constructed across the Gallatin River to the Squaw Creek Ranger Station. Completed in 1936, the steel-reinforced bridge has two approach spans, 26 feet each, a center span of 96 feet, and a roadway 18 feet wide. And I've been practicing on the timing here, so this would come up at the same time. So once again, I'm off by about 20 seconds. There she is. Okay. I'll get it right one of these years. CCC men across the country, they began calling themselves Roosevelt's Tree Army. They were grateful for the work, but like this anonymous member, they also enjoyed a little jocularity over their situation. And he wrote this poem. Roosevelt's my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down on a straw mattress. He leadeth me inside a mess hall. He restoreth my job. He leadeth me in the paths of reforestation for his country's sake. Yes, though I walk through the valley of the shadows of poison oak and ivy, I will fear no evil, for he is with me. He prepareth the saw and axe before me. In the presence of my commanding officer, he anointeth my mind with discipline. My shoes runneth over from marching. Surely beans and employment will follow me all the days of Roosevelt's administration, and I shall dwell in a tent forever. Dell Williams, he joined the Corps at Red Lodge, and he was transferred to Squaw Creek in the autumn of 1935. And we're quoting him here. He says that the projects at Squaw Creek consisted of much construction, such as roads and trails, telephone lines, the Gallatin River Bridge, and the Ranger's dwelling. Also, there were logging crews and the usual heavy firefighting in the summer months. Williams stayed with the CCC until mid-November 1940 when he landed a civilian job with the U.S. Forest Service. And then quoting him again, from that day in Red Lodge, Montana, and for some 30 years and 5 months, I didn't have a single day's break in service from the government. The tenure included, of course, the CCC, then the Forest Service, the Army, the Federal Supply Service, GSA, and Alaska Indian Affairs. This last agency was the one from which I retired in 1965. My college education was that obtained during those 5.5 years in the CCC camps. All CCC camps, including Squaw Creek, offered an array of evening vocational classes in machine operation, typing, block printing, wood carving, etc. Recruits could complete grade school and high school requirements by successfully finishing the evening courses. Those who completed college-level courses could earn credits from the University of Montana. The men jokingly referred to Camp F-57 as the University of Squaw Creek, where in 1936 there were a total of 22 instructors teaching 57 pupils. Boy, that's a pretty good teacher-to-student ratio, isn't it? Holy cow. Howard Haggerty, who joined the CCC in 1935 and was stationed at Squaw Creek, was not discouraged by the rugged conditions. Quote, I was maturing and learning, he recalled. Camp activities were interesting enough to counteract homesickness. Sports, rec hall, night classes, town trips, girls, infrequent weekend trips home, hunting, fishing. Haggerty garnered enough experience at Squaw Creek and completed enough courses to earn work on the Fort Peck Dam and eventually maintenance work on the Panama Canal. Quoting again, I'm convinced that my CCC experience did more for my self-confidence and the building and improving of my character in 21 months than 4 years of college could have. By 1939, applications for the CCC began to decline. Roosevelt's Lend-Lease program, to cite just one example, created jobs in the armaments industry. As other opportunities in the private sector began to reemerge, the lure of the CCC began to wane. At the onset of 1941, the Corps had declined to 200,000 enrollees. And then with the attack on Pearl Harbor, everyone's attention turned to the war effort. Congress never abolished the CCC. It simply decided not to fund the program, save an $8 million appropriation to cover liquidation. So the legacy of the Civilian Conservation Corps remains evident today, thanks to the roads, the bridges, the dams, and other improvements its members constructed. Between 1933 and 1941, an estimated 3 million men served in the Civilian Conservation Corps. They built 97,000 miles of truck roads and 3,470 fire towers. They helped with flood control and lent 4,135,000 man days in fighting fires. They also planted close to 3 billion, that is with a B, trees, many part of an extensive shelter belt system in states that were ravaged during the Dust Bowl era. In Region 1, CCC members built more than 2,500 miles of forest roads. They installed 44,184 signs, markers, and monuments, planted trees on some 27,000 acres, strung hundreds of miles of telephone line, and constructed 93 lookout houses while giving 371,647 worker days fighting forest fires. As evidenced by Dell Williams and Howard Haggerty, there was another important legacy that was left by the CCC. The education courses offered in the camps allowed these young men to prepare for the workforce, to have the needed skills to garner a good-paying job when the economy rebounded. The vocational skills they learned proved important during World War II. The grade school, high school, and college courses allowed thousands to obtain diplomas. An estimated 40,000 men who were illiterate when they joined the CCC were able to read and write by the time they finished their service. Now, going back to the beginning, one of the interesting aspects of the program, again, evidence still exists in the Gallatin Canyon, and I think the Lewis and Clark Caverns. I think that's also another example. President Roosevelt felt you had to do something to get people to work. You had to get money into the economy flowing again. Kind of like what we've been debating and going back and forth over in the last couple of years. But Roosevelt told his cabinet and he told congressional leaders, the American people will not take a handout and I'm not going to give them one. If they want to earn a wage, they're going to work for it. And on top of that, we're going to make it even more enticing by offering the opportunities to pick up a trade, and for many of these guys, the opportunity for them to learn to read and write. $30 a month salary was not a lot of money. and you had to send $25 of that back home. That left $5 a month. I don't know what beer costs once Prohibition ended, or, you know, what it would cost to take a girl dancing or something like that, but that's all they had. Everything else was taken care of for them. But as you can see by the statistics, they really did put in a great deal of work, and a lot of the benefits are today. I think especially where it was beneficial, from what I've been able to ascertain, it was a help here, especially during firefighting season. But you look at the Midwest, how the soil, how the land had been treated for years, and then it all erupted with the Dust Bowl era. But with the establishment of shelter belts and more trees to solidify that area, that really played a huge role in kind of bringing that land back. We could debate all day the value or efficacy or whatever you want to call it of government programs. But on the surface, anyway, this one appears to have been one that did quite well. Now, I noticed there's some people here who brought some notes, may have brought some pictures. And what we want to do today is something a little bit different. Last week when we were talking about Custer, I didn't know if we'd ever get out of here. But I think what I'd like to do is we'll have an open mic session. Anybody who would like to talk about their study of the CCC, maybe you had a relative or a friend who was part of the Civilian Conservation Corps, things like that, that you'd like to share with this audience, I'm going to invite you to come up here and not be bashful. Just give us your name and, you know, give us your little spiel. But before we do that, a word from our sponsor. There's a rumor going around town that I kind of need to put the kibosh on, okay, because it's not true. The rumor says that if you make a $10,000 donation to the Gallatin Historical Society, then we will prove that you're related to John Bozeman. This is false. This is not true. But if you give us $25,000, we'll prove you are John Bozeman. We rely on donations, memberships. We're not taxpayer-supported. In order for us to continue operation of this museum and to offer programs similar to the ones we're doing this month, plus many of the others that we do, we're going to need the support of the community, and that support can come through memberships, donations, donations, donations. You know, the rule about real estate, the three most important things, location, location, location. If you become a member, since we are a 501c3, it is tax deductible to the extent allowed by law. You get 10% off anything you buy in the bookstore. And you get our quarterly history magazine. And we've really kind of pulled out all stops for this latest issue to see what we can to get people to join, especially you guys. It's our swimsuit issue. Swimsuits from the 1920s, obviously. But still, each one is 40 pages long. You can also help us by volunteering. We have a lot of volunteers here in the audience today who work here. And for example, Byron and Kay, and they help edit the magazine. Mark Miller, Norma's, all kinds. They're all over the place in here. We have lots of volunteers, and we're grateful for their help. So any support you can lend, this building needs repairs, and there's things we're doing on the inside here that we want to continue to be able to do. And we'll need your assistance in order to do that. So, and if you paid to get in, you can apply your admission to this, to your membership, when this is over. And since you did, of course, pay to get in, take advantage of it, and after we're done here, take a look at some of the things we have on exhibit or what's going on in our research center. We're the only ones that devote ourselves to the history of Gallatin County in southwest Montana. So, having said all that, now it's like they do at the bars sometimes. It's open mic time. And if anybody is willing to come up and talk about who they know, Anything you want to relate about the Civilian Conservation Corps? I'm sure you folks out there probably have some really good valuable information. Come on up.
I'm Bob Cron. Some of you may remember me or look like you're old enough. I was a district ranger at Squaw Creek Ranger Station, the last district ranger there, 1970 to 1976. Jane and I and our daughter lived in that house that the CCC's built there. I'm just going to fill in a couple of things. I assume you're all familiar with the geography, but it was skipped over rather quickly. The original Squaw Creek Ranger Station was on the south side of Squaw Creek, where it runs into the Gallatin River, okay? And there was a bridge there. That's why they had to build a road north 2 miles to get to the new site, okay? The other thing I want to add is that the CCC's built not only the residence, but they built the office, built the warehouse, they built the horse facility there and another small facility. So when you go to that station, which is a workstation now, all those buildings were built by the CCC's. Finally, I have been trying to get the Forest Service to designate this site a historic site for quite a few years now. And I have a meeting with them on the ground at 12:30 on Thursday. If any of you want to come, I'd be glad to show you where the foundations were of the CCC camp. That's what I'm going to show the Forest Service, and I'm going to look them in the eye and see if they won't get off the dime and get the ball rolling to make it a historic site for the bridge, for the old CCC camp, and for the ranger station. Thank you. Do you have any questions for me? Yes. Well, the ranger station is right where the new bridge is. Wait till we get the right picture. It sits back here. The main road goes to the right towards Squaw Creek, and you turn left to go into the station, but it's only 100 yards away. That's the house right there. There's the bridge. That was the house. It's across the horse pasture from where you park to the east. You want to find the current ranger station? The original, are you talking about the original ranger station where there's nothing there except a foundation? Which way are you walking, upstream or downstream? Okay, you're walking south, and it's to your left. But it's right there. You can see them from where you park. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
How far is it to walk where you park?
100 yards? Yeah. Thank you.
This is Dave Swingle, a retired teacher from the school district, and the name of the museum you work with now is...
The Other Museum.
All right, thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Yeah, there are four good museums in this town, and a lot of people overlook that. This one I probably have the closest tie to, having been a resident here one time after a really bad fight in the Ellen Theater. Dr. Strangelove was showing there, and the students thought it was really wild and cool, and the older audience thought it was offensively unpatriotic. And a bad fight broke out in the lobby and went out into the street. And the sheriff brought us here and said, you're all spending the night. They didn't book us, but it was sort of a lesson to us. So I remember this bank of cells up here. And there was a big drunk tank about where many of you guys are appropriately sitting. Anyhow, on the CCC, I ran the alternative high school here in town for 14 years. And one of the real problems with underemployed youth is, how do you employ them? Well, a certain number are shipped off into the food trade, turning burgers over, which produces maybe a future, because some of the restaurants like McDonald's do have a workup system toward manager, and that's good. But in terms of something that's really broad, like this program was during the Depression, I think it's really essential. Speaking politically, very disappointed in the current administration of missing the boat right after the inauguration, of not simply doing what Roosevelt did and rehabilitating a massive public works program to get stuff that's infrastructure, which you can see all over the place here falling down, but nationwide. and then also with skills packages involved so people can become construction workers and related, and especially with the amount of computer stuff which is done now. But that was missed. But it's really tough to get people that don't have well-to-do families, people that really know are connected, to be able to get connected if you're out of it. You know, Bozeman is, in my view, the capital of denial. We don't have any poor people here. We don't have any homeless people. We don't have any at-risk youth. In the state, in this state, Bozeman District was the last district by 16 years to have any kind of a at-risk program for high school students. Now, Kalispell, which is a working-class labor town and much higher unemployment, has had two programs since 1965. Very effective, very continuous parenting centers, and really effective. Now, I work around here. I grew up here, and my grandparents came here originally as botanists for the campus, and they laid out quite a few of the basic trails in both what's now the Spanish-speaks primitive area and also in Highlight Canyon. And these marked trails, Forest Service had done quite a bit to CCC, made them passable, really took care of the issues of swamps and bridges, and got the treadways so they're in better shape. And the Forest Service has done a great job, and private agencies since, in managing them. Something on the tree planting, it's the shelter belts are really important. In fact, a few years ago I was traveling across North Dakota, and I kept coming across these vast jungles in long rows, and what they were shelter belts that had gotten overaged. They were mixtures of conifers, and they planted a lot of Russian olive. And Russian olive acts as a hedge, but also it gets on the prairie and becomes, I think now it's a banned species, I believe, in Montana for further planting, although I have some in my yard you're welcome to have. But the shelter belts took hold, and they really do work, but in the part of the CCC, and there's a very fine PBS documentary that runs every so often, and look for it, in the east, on the really heavily logged over eroded areas, in the Shenandoah and Appalachian areas, quite a few of those were massively replanted with appropriate species of trees, and now they're beautiful. But when you see the eroded landscape, the moonscape, left by two centuries of essentially clear-cutting and plowing, what the CCC and other agencies did in saving those lands and getting them to reconstruct, very important. Flood control work, fire control work, the road building. But the other thing on World War II, and it can't be underestimated, is having a physically fit, fairly literate workforce used to military-type discipline and also a lot of boxing. There's a tremendous amount of boxing and grudge fighting in these camps, where instead of brawling, they actually put up a ring and you duked it out with the guy you're mad at. Anyway, these people went in and became the core of Army and Navy. A little sidelight on that is on a land-grant college like this, a number of the young men stayed on, and after they left the CCC, they liked the area, they came back and entered MSU. I have quite a good record of that going through. On MSU, keep in mind that the entire 1940-41 football team starting line was killed in World War II. Real high casualty rate. The secondary players, some survived, but there was no other campus in the country, as far as we know, that lost its entire starting lineup for 2 years. Mike Mansfield, when his majority leader, read a number of things into the record on that. And when you look at what you get in these kinds of wartime situation, is you need an officer corps. And in the Army, usually the first person over the top is the lieutenant. They usually are the point, and they tend to take the brunt of fire. In Montana and in New Mexico, Mexico was number one in casualty rate in World War II, and Montana was second. And you look at that, well, you have all these CC boys, and you have these football players, and blacksmiths, and cowboys, and skiers, and mountaineers, and young forest rangers. These people went in, and they also tended to be commissioned, or they tended to rise in non-commissioned rank very rapidly. So it put them at risk, and you end up with a profound loss of some of the best, the brightest, and most physically fit. So it goes into sort of the whole national, the suffering of the war, the eventual victory. But there's a long, long history there. I think one of the things that's too bad about the CCC is there wasn't a corresponding female section also applying women to appropriate work. There is a difference in physical size and ability to, you know, run a double bit axe all day long, but there were a number of ways that women would have really benefited from a similar federal program to get them educated, trained, essentially into national service. But we tend to, historically, lose about half of our talent by ignoring the skills and strength of women. That's probably all I have to say on it. Just that it's a heritage that cannot be overlooked. It's so important to what it did. Now consider a world with non-CCC. Suppose we had this Great Depression, total financial collapse, and vast numbers of fairly ignorant, unemployed youth sort of wandering around. That could have really been a national catastrophe that we might not have recovered from. Just simply a permanently high crime underclass. You see it a bit now with at-risk youth. That free enterprise will always work. It's just what you're freely selling and trading may not be in the best interest of you or society. And it's one thing to sell some weed. And by the way, I used to favor legalization, and I don't anymore after seeing what it does to an initiative. But people get into selling meth, manufacturing meth. Suppose you had a whole population that was moonshining and beginning to push cocaine and the rest of it. It could have been a catastrophe. It was, in my view, Roosevelt administration had a lot of drawbacks, but this is one of the best things it did.
Thanks, Dave. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you can, well, also there and here, look at the war industry, the Rosie the Riveter types. Without all that manufacturing, without all the women involved, I don't know that we could have won the war. So, but yeah, no, some really interesting and good points made here. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, this lady was mentioning the fact that in West Virginia, a lot of the work that the CCC did in that part of the country is kind of going by the wayside now because of mining. A lot of mountains, well, as you said, the top's blown off. I guess their term would be lowering, flattened in order to access coal. And so a lot of the marks left by CCC are fading away in that part of the country. Yes. The question is, what is the ownership status of the property now, and maybe still part of the national forest? It still is part of the national forest, Gallatin National Forest. Yes. No, she was saying that a lot of women mathematicians were instrumental in the war effort. Actually, before the age of computers, calculating where bombs should be dropped.
Good morning. I'm Francine Spang Willis, and actually, Bob, I'm working with the Forest Service. I'm with Marcia Pablo, and so I will be coming on that interview with her on Thursday. So good to know you beforehand. And you said your wife's name is Jane. Okay. Well, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about myself. I'm, of course, going to bring a Native American perspective. I grew up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, and actually my grandfather, Spang is not traditionally a Northern Cheyenne name, came from the East Coast. Him and his brother came out during a gold rush, and he married into the Northern Cheyenne, married a lady, and they had 13 kids, and they were homesteaders, and those 13 kids had, like, each, I think, 7 kids. And so, consequently, we have the Spang family is the biggest family on Northern Cheyenne. But I grew up, of course, knowing both sides of my heritage and was taught to be very proud of both sides. And so currently I'm getting my master's degree right now in Native American Studies at MSU Bozeman, and will go on and get my doctorate after I'm done. Not sure if it'll be in Native American Studies or American Studies at this point. But I wanted to just mention that, you know, as part of my master's program, I teach Introduction to Native American Studies, and so we do talk about the Bozeman Trail. We talk about look at history. We do look at history from the Native American perspective. Prior to coming here, I lived in Billings, Montana, and worked for the Western Heritage Center Museum there, which is a small museum such as this, and was the visionary for the American Indian Tribal Histories Project, which we received about $4.6 million over about 6 years from the Department of Interior, Office of Indian Education, and we were able to conduct oral histories and produce educational DVDs that went into the K-12 school system, and actually they do use them in the NAS program here at MSU Bozeman. And we created or developed exhibits, traveling exhibits, language presentations, state-of-the-art oral history archive collection, and just on and on and on. But what I just wanted to say was, like, the Native perspective is, you know, often it's marginalized and overlooked. And I think, you know, you guys did an awesome job of, John, you did an awesome job of your presentation. I was very interested in the CCC, because that's part of my job now with the Forest Service is, you know, we're going to be looking at making this a historical site. But one of the things I just wanted to say, is that, you know, when I teach NAS and I said we look at things from the Native perspective, and one of the things that, as I was sitting here listening and enjoying the presentation, of course there is the one thing that kept bothering me was every time you say squaw, you know, and of course historically I know what that means. And so, and I'm sitting there, and every time you say it, I'm like cringing. I'm like, I can't, you know, it's like I can't get over it. And it's very unfortunate. And I just wanted to bring that forward, that it is, you know, still offensive. And as I was taught, you know, it is an offensive word, describing Native women. And so it's hard for me to listen to this presentation, and I don't know how that's gonna, you know, play out, over the long run. But I just wanted you guys to be aware of that and how it still affects people. Yes. What is the name now? Shenango? Okay. Okay, so I just wanted you guys to be aware of that. You know, I'm not trying to like be like a Debbie Downer or anything like that. I just want you guys to know that it does still affect people, in a negative way. And, you know, that's one of the things that I try to teach, the students in my class. Every semester I have about 50 students, and probably 90% of them are, well, probably like 45 out of the 50 are non-native. And so we talk about things like this. We talk about, you know, just historically, you know, how we call things different things, and how, you know, Native Americans might have already had a name for them. And, you know, we just talk about a lot of different concepts and ideologies, and where, you know, where ideologies come from and how they're perpetuated over time, and how we can make that change to positively affect people. So, yes.
I'm aware.
Each tribe probably had their own name for, you know, their women, for the women. Yeah, and there's like 500 and today there's like 560 different nations in the United States, and I'm sure, you know, before that it was before. It is. It is. It, the connotation is an insulting meaning. Yes. Yes, kind of going down that same road. Yes, yes. Yes, it's kind of, it's not a compliment to women. And I don't know, I don't understand why, I guess, that, I don't know. I mean, like I said, ideologies come down and they mean different things to... You know, even when I teach my intro to NAS, you know, a lot of them, like you guys, are like, well, what does that mean? You know, like when I grew up, I just thought it meant, you know, a female. And I don't really want to be offensive, so I don't really, I guess we could speak about it like after and talk about what it means to me, or I can, you know, but I don't, that's not my point, is like to say like, oh, sure, for sure. Yes. Or I can do it here. I mean, it doesn't matter. I don't want to offend anybody here, but, I can speak to you. Okay. Okay. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. And the point is well taken. And when I started to research this, that was running through my mind. But at the time that the CCC was there and they called it the University of Squaw Creek, and that was the name of the creek at the time. I guess, I don't know if it's a fair analogy, but the debate over whether or not the N-word should be taken out of Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, that too is an extremely offensive word. Unfortunately, it was used in our history. But you bring up a good point. And it is something I wrestled with. I didn't know what else to call it, but what it was called at the time. And I'm glad you shared your perspective on that, and I thank you. We're not necessarily supposed to feel good about all of our history. We're not supposed to. We shouldn't have to. And I think, as ugly as some of the words are, and they are, to an extent, you need to remember them so they don't come back again, if that makes sense. Okay. Hey, it's open mic time.
That's all right.
No.
You want to do some karaoke?
Okay. Not even that either. I don't know if you can hear me or not. Anyway, I just want to reiterate everything that's been said about the CCC program. It's probably one of the greatest things that was ever done. And I grew up hearing about the CCC camp because my dad served in it during all the years that it was in progress. He was road crew foreman at Squaw Creek. He was road crew foreman at Highlight Canyon. He served in St. Regis. He served in West Yellowstone. And I heard many, many wonderful stories. He taught young men from New Jersey, New York, at Squaw Creek Camp. I do have a book, if anybody would like to look at some of those pictures that he has kept over the years. And now my brother, Carl, and I have the privilege of knowing all those years. So I just wanted to say thank you. This was great. My name is Carolyn Martin. My dad was Carl Martin. My brother is Carl Martin Jr.
Yeah. Thank you. I think a lot of good opinions, a lot of good... Yes, sir. Did you want to come up?
I'm Bob Bellows. Worked at Fort Keogh in Miles City for 39 years. And I was superintendent there for 5 years, and... As some of you may know, this is a very active research station, cattle research. And during my tenure, the corrals and so on began to become quite decrepit. So for animal care as well as worker safety, we had to replace those corrals. And as we were pulling the posts out, I noticed on every one of the large posts that were there, there was a CCC stamped on the bottom of all of those posts. So I did just a little bit of research as to where they'd come from. They all came from the Gallatin Canyon. The CCC men pulled those posts out, or those trees out. They were peeled. They were taken down. As near as I could tell, they were treated in Bozeman someplace. I don't know where that was. But they were shipped by railroad to Miles City, and all of those corrals were built with material that came from the Gallatin Canyon, and it was supplied through the efforts of the CCC boys. And those corrals had been there probably about 45 to 50 years. And so you can see that not only were they high quality, but we were very interested in establishing where they actually had come from. So they, not only did they have a marked effect on the people that were working there, as we've heard so nicely this morning, but also they had a far-reaching effect because it was from there, as John has mentioned, a lot of the shelter belt work was started there, and a lot of the work with the Russian olive that originated, or not originated, but was carried on out of Fort Keogh. And as you may well know, Russian olives have now been declared an invasive species, and they can't be used anymore. But just an interesting sidelight of the far-reaching effect of the CCC camp. Thank you.
I think in some instances they were booted out. You know, if you were a troublemaker or what have you, I think you'd just get the civilian equivalent of a dishonorable discharge, right? Something like that, yeah. That's my understanding. Some of them were kicked out. Oh, yeah, I imagine they did. Yeah. Well, kind of, I appreciate all the thoughts, all the comments for clarification, for historical perspective that everybody has offered. I should have mentioned at the onset, for those who participated in the open mic portion, we're recording this. I know what you're thinking. Oh, Russell, now you tell me. All right. But it's something that will be in our archives. Okay. If the day ever comes, eventually we'll have transcripts. But if the day ever comes when people want to use what was said here today for research purposes, there's some public radio stations that are interested in some of these presentations, as well as what we have in our oral history collection for possible use in on public radio. So I thank all of those who participated in open mic. I hope that's not a problem for anybody if what we discussed, what was said, is used basically to educate and perhaps enlighten some future generations.